Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. And it is game week, Stu. It's about time. We are going to get into a lot of stuff related to the start of the season. We also have two guests in this power-packed show. We're going to have Yogi Roth from the Pac-12 Network. And we are going to be joined a little later by our colleague from The Athletic, who covers the Nebraska Cornhuskers, coming from Dublin, Ireland, no less, Mitch Sherman. We will get to them in a little bit.
I don't know that we've ever had a guest on from a foreign country, have we? I can't imagine we have.
No, not unless you took one of your Paris vacations and hopped on a Zoom without telling me.
I'm excited. No, we have our, going live to Dublin. And Mitch, by the way, is doing us a solid because he just flew in there on the red eye. However, like 8 hours ago or something. I don't know. He went to practice. He did interviews. So looking forward to getting his report.
Conference predictions have gone up, and you have one that really caught my eye to the point where you told me about it before I clicked on the link, and I was like, "Wait, what?" And I thought it was a typo. It just jumps out at me. So there was news this week, or last week actually, out of Austin, that Quinn Ewers, not shocking, but that he was going to be announced as the starting quarterback for the Longhorns. Just by looking at what you think, you are not a big believer in Quinn Ewers or this Texas team. You have them going 4-8 this year and 2-7 in the cellar of the Big 12, along with TCU. I'm surprised about TCU. I am shocked by how little you think of the Texas Longhorns right now. Please explain.
If this actually goes to where I picked it, and let's be honest, no conference ever finishes exactly the way you predicted it. It would be the wildest year in Big 12 history, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The Big 12 has been nutty a lot, so I don't even know if I would say it that way.
Well, but for 6 years in a row, it was very two. It was Oklahoma, Oklahoma, Oklahoma. Now you've got a massive coaching change at Oklahoma. We'll talk about K-State in a second. I'm a big Lance Leipold believer. I don't have Kansas finishing last in the Big 12. But let me just first start with Texas by saying this. Does anybody remember what Texas' record was last year?
Yes, they were 5-7 and 3-6 in the league. And you think they're going to be even worse in
year? I don't know why this is so revolutionary that I might think they might win fewer game than last year. We don't know. I mean, Quinn Ewers is we've been hearing about him for 2 years. He's got all these NIL deals. He was the five, at one point had the highest rating in 247 history. But at the end of the day, we have not seen a second of him other than I was actually at the Ohio State Michigan State game last year where he came in to hand the ball off a couple times. So we know nothing of him. We do know Bijan Robinson. He's very good. We know Xavier Worthy. He's very good. Texas, what troubles me most, well, the defense troubles me most, but second to that is they are going to be starting multiple freshmen on their offensive line. They are very highly rated offensive linemen, so I don't want to make it seem like they're slouches by any means, but the combination of inexperienced freshman offensive linemen with a freshman quarterback, and remember, he should be a true freshman this year, and a very suspect defense is not a recipe for success, in my opinion.
Man, 4-8, though, Stu. I'm going to, while we were talking about this, I was like, when was the last time Texas was actually this bad? Do you know when it was?
Charlie Strong. Didn't they have a 4-8 year?
No. I don't think so. They had a 5-7 year twice, but 4-8, there's a coach I'm almost embarrassed to say I've never heard of this person. Edwin Price. He went 1-9 the year before Daryl Royal got hired in 1956.
You're kidding me. They haven't lost 8 games since then?
No.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that, but I could have sworn they had a 4-8. Here's the thing.
They've had some 4-7s.
Here's Texas's record since 2010. Here are their records. 5-7, 8-5, 9-4, 8-5, 6-7. 5-7, 5-7, 7-6, 10-4, 8-5, 7-3, 5-7. My point being, losing records are not exactly a rarity in Texas these days. It's just that 4-8 is.
So let me go ask you this step on Quinn. You think Quinn Ewers is going to be really bad this year?
I wouldn't say that. I just don't.
You
I think
are
I
saying
would,
that 4-8.
I just don't think he's going to come in and be Trevor Lawrence like a lot of Texas fans or recruiting people expect. I don't think he has.
I mean, never mind Trevor Lawrence. If they're going to go, forget Trevor Lawrence. If they're going to go 4-8, you're going to think he's going to be like Joey Lawrence. That is like you were comparing. If you're 4-8, you have a quarterback who's probably not holding his job.
I think you have a quarterback who's playing like a freshman quarterback. You know, we have seen some exceptions to the rule recently, like Trevor Lawrence, but for the most part, freshman quarterbacks take their lumps and then they get better from there. So
but
treating him like a freshman quarterback.
Freshman quarterbacks usually do not have one of the two best running backs in the country and one of the most explosive receivers in the country, though. And also, by the way, you know, you can say what you want about Sark as a head coach. Sark's a really good quarterbacks guy. He's a really good offensive coach. Again, I'm not trying to say they're going, you know, 8-4, but I was like, wow, I can't believe you think they're going to be god awful this year.
I didn't go into it necessarily expecting to pick them to go 4-8, maybe 6-6 or so. But my thing is, there's just a lot of teams in the Big 12. So I think there's a window of opportunity in the Big 12 this year, because when you think about the top three teams from last year, everybody knows, I've been saying it all offseason, I think Oklahoma's going to struggle between a massive coaching transition and losing Caleb Williams and a whole bunch of other key guys from last season, especially transfers. Baylor lost kind of their heart and soul guys on defense, guys who'd been there 5 years. Oklahoma State lost Jim Knowles and a bunch of those five-year guys. There is an opportunity for some surprise teams this year, whether it's West Virginia, whether it's maybe Iowa State not falling back as much as you think. And of course, the team that I picked to win the Big 12, Kansas State.
Okay, by the way, so I apologize. I did not listen to a word you just said, because I'm looking at the headline of your story, right? And we used to joke about this. Our old podcast editor, Teddy Mitrosilis, really smart guy, was very creative with with what we were saying to make kind of jazz it up. I think you could jazz up your Stuart Mandel's Big 12 predictions. Right now it says, is it K-State's year in a conference of change? You know what it should say? Stuart Mandel's Big 12 predictions.
Texas is going to be a tire fire.
Texas is going to suck.
You're right. Seriously. We probably get a lot more subscriptions off of that, but I don't write the headlines, and I'm not somebody that I'm looking. I mean, Oklahoma fans are the most furious at me. I actually haven't gotten much Texas.
I don't think they know how abysmal you think they're going to be.
Well, Oklahoma fans figured it out pretty quick.
But you've been down on Oklahoma pretty much from, you know, like from basically the dead of the winter.
Well, let's put it this way. You do these preseason predictions too sometimes, and you know, like there's a lot of groupthink, and sometimes you know people think it's a really big deal if you pick a team that is widely expected to go 10-2 to go 9-3, right? People are like, oh, what are you thinking? But I got to think that if Texas actually went 4-8, you can't, I mean, look, forget if they actually go to pick them to go 4-8 is quite a difference from whoever coach it was that picked them first in the country.
Stu, I mean, just looking at your predictions, I feel like there's only probably two fan bases that will appreciate you for this. And that's pretty hard to do. You've almost pissed off everybody.
They're both in the same state.
Yeah, I know. It's like, you'll be drinking for free.
What do you think about Kansas? I
like Lance Leipold. I feel like I've been touting him since he got the Buffalo job. I don't think that's far fetched. I think they're probably 3-9, 4-8 ish. I don't think that's crazy. I mean, they did a good job.
I almost picked them to go 5-7. And then I looked, and Kansas has not won more than one Big 12 game in a season, much less three, since 2008. So that seemed like a little bit of a stretch. But I do think you'll see progress from them this year. I think Neil Brown will have a little bit of a breakthrough at West Virginia. There's not a playoff team in this conference, I don't think, but there's a lot of depth and a lot of wild cards, right? Like I have TCU tied for ninth with Texas, but you tell me TCU is going to rise up and win eight games. There's not much that could happen in this conference this year that would shock me.
You know what I love most about your rankings, though? I'm looking at this and going, okay, you know, JT Daniels' team is going to go 7-5. You already said Quinn Ewers is going to vomit all over himself. You're not big on Max Duggan, apparently. You're not big on Dylan Gabriel.
Sonny Dykes hasn't necessarily assured us that Max Duggan is the guy. He's talking about playing three quarterbacks.
Here's the thing. Who's the quarterback who's going to go in and tear this up and lead his team to the conference championship? Our guy, Adrian Martinez.
I know, and I've totally come around on him, haven't I?
All it took was one Max Olson 4,000-word feature to get you. Get
that was hearts. God bless Max. That was a great feature.
I've been touting him to you, and they had nobody around him or little around him in Lincoln. Now all of a sudden he goes to the Big 12, and I'm surprised you didn't put him in our Heisman draft.
First of all, he has a really, really, really good around him named Deuce Vaughn. Nebraska did not have, in his entire 4 years there, a running back the caliber of Deuce Vaughn, who is a stud. But I mostly just think that what he needed most, and that's not the first time I've said this, was a change of scenery. And, you know, in Max's story, he actually talks pretty candidly about kind of losing confidence as the years went by in Nebraska and the turnovers and the losses piling up. Basically, he had a very promising freshman season, and then he took a step back as a sophomore, and I'm not sure he ever quite got over that. So I think fresh start will really help him. I also just, it's Kansas State's offense. He doesn't have to come in and pass for 4,000 yards. His be decent. Him as a running threat along with Deuce Vaughn. And then that defense, the Kansas State defense, you know, you saw two teams last year in that conference, Baylor and Oklahoma State, rise up, field really good defenses because they had a bunch of fifth year dudes who just played their, you know, best football of their career so far. Kansas State has a bunch of those dudes this year.
All right. Can't wait to see the reception you get when you roll into Austin with the Crimson Tide that weekend.
Yeah. Well, by the way, the Crimson Tide is somewhat contributing to that prediction. There's been a long history of, you know, this is the first year in forever they don't have a neutral site opener, but there's been a long history of whichever team they demolish in that neutral site opener goes on to have a terrible year. It's just like they just demoralize them. I have a feeling Will Anderson and those guys going up against those freshman offensive linemen could really shake up Texas this season. But who knows? Hey, if they pull the upset and I'm there, you know, I'm sure I will have to buy torchies for everybody.
You should at least buy it for me. All right, Stu, can't wait to see what happens in Austin. But before that, and before a lot of things, let's get to our first guest. All right, now we're pleased to be joined by our guest, one of our favorite people that we meet in the college football world. He is Yogi Roth, the lead analyst of all things Pac-12 Network, former Pitt receiver, former USC assistant coach, best-selling author of Pete Carroll's book, Win Forever. You've done so many hats, but I do want to talk about the newest book you have called Five Star QB. It's not about the stars. It's about the journey, which you wrote with Joey Roberts. You guys are integral parts of the Elite 11. You have a unique perspective on it. I really want to dig into that as well as Pac-12, but thanks for joining us on the Audible today.
Bruce, every time I sit down with you in one of these sessions, I flash back to early days in L.A., and you doing it now and you did it then, but you were always just so kind to me as like a young coach trying to figure it out. And then I can remember going to a restaurant in Manhattan Beach. I think it was called Town. And it was when I was leaving coaching and you're like, dude, what's going on? And we had this talk for, I felt like a couple hours. And I always go back to that moment because you've always like found the human in athletes and you saw it in me that day as well. And I'm fired up to be on the show with you now, man.
No, it's great. You're definitely one of my favorite people. And somebody who feel like you were able to do both. You're living like four lives at once and you're always optimistic and have a great outlook on it. And I thought, so, you know, obviously I had done a book on quarterbacks and at the beginning of it really was my time around the Elite 11 group that you guys you're a big part of and Joey Roberts, is a big part of. And it was really when Trent Dilfer, I don't say took over the Elite 11, but had a bigger hand in it, moving up from Andy Bark and Bob Johnson in its earlier days. And what I thought was so amazing about this book you guys have done is it's really in the voice of all these quarterbacks. And when I say all these quarterbacks, like I happen to open it up to a page where it's talking, you guys ask them about mental health. And it is a real current topic. And it's a really interesting perspective. And you have, I mean, just for to give people an idea, you know, so many of these quarterbacks are like their names all, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know most of the names. Now, some of them were better, turn out to be better quarterbacks than others. They're not all five-star guys. Some of the guys you had there might have been high three stars, and maybe they lived up to it. Like Sam Darnold was a huge recruit when you guys invited him, but then he blew up. But just on this page, everyone from Jimmy Clausen to Sam Ellinger to Bo Nix to Shea Patterson to Garrett Gilbert, Gerard Hurd, Phillip Sims, John David Booty with a really interesting answer. And then you can see like Davis Mills, JJ McCarthy. I mean, it's pretty much everybody who's come through there. And I thought it's way more than a snapshot. It's just fascinating to see what they think of it now. So I would ask you this, what do you want people to take from this book as you guys kind of really set out and then you started to mine through all this stuff you got?
Yeah, I think there's three areas that really this book can hit home. One, it's for the players. And what I love about the cover, Bruce, is we were figuring this out. What do you want the cover to look like? You've done it a bunch of times. And I really netted out at the end with Joey if we wanted it to be the faces of these players. Because so often five-star recruits or big-time recruits, all of a sudden they're labeled with a ranking. And then what does a fan do? Oh, what's his highlights look like? How big is his arm? What does he do on social media? What does he look like in his uniform? They don't see his face. And I wanted to, along with Joey, wanted to give these quarterbacks an opportunity to say who they are. And that's why we went down this road. And it was kind of inspired by even your oral history of the position a couple of years ago, where you had a handful of guys in it. We're like, let's attack this whole group and give them a platform to share their story, their journey from the first day they were offered, somewhere in eighth grade, to advice to their younger self. And that's kind of the bookend of the book and everything in between in terms of how to deal with mental health, as you referenced, how to deal with women on campus, how to deal with transferring, how to deal with a coach, how to deal with transferring twice, how to deal with starting, what's it like to play? Trying to unearth every question. But the first thing is that you're hearing it from these guys. And what was really gratifying for us is I would get a text or a call from Gunnar Keel, Ryan Burns. I mean, you can go down the list and they would say, it felt really good to do this. It felt really good. It was kind of scary. And I had a bunch of emotions, but I got to answer a lot of questions around my quarterback journey. So I think that's one. I think two is that if you're a parent of a walk-on, like my parents were, or you're the parent of Bryce Young, right? And Craig Young is in this book. Kimberly Stroud is in this book. Lisa McCaffrey is in this book in terms of advice to parents. If you're a parent, you can't Google how to be the parent of a walk-on or how to be the parent of the top recruit in America. There's no way to figure it out, other than just figure it out on the fly, kind of like parenting, as you and I have learned over the course of the last few years. We wanted to give them a relative guidebook or something to turn to from advice from ambassadors of the game, like Chip Kelly, David Shaw, Pete Carroll, John Schneider, Ryan Day, Dan Lanning, Lincoln Riley, yourself, you're in the book, super grateful for that, just to give them some feedback and some principles. And then the third one is for fans. I think fans will really dig getting to know Gerard Hurd's path, as you reference his name, who went to Texas as a quarterback, left Texas as a wide receiver, is playing semi-professional football right now. Or Brady White, who went to multiple schools. Or David Cornwell, who was the man at Alabama when he came in, but then Blake Barnett, they're labeled as busts. And I think as fans read this, they'll recognize that like that term should be eliminated, because a lot of these young men have felt such vitriol from fan bases, as well as such adulation. Right? There's a line in the book. I'll stop here. There's a line in the book from a quarterback who says, on my visit, the student section was cheering my name. And after starting for two seasons, they were booing my name. And I just think that is a nutshell that every fan should receive and say, yeah, let me just hit pause before I DM somebody and say that they should die. Because that happens once a year. We know that. And that's intense, but that's the truth. And I loved where the book went in that regard. So those are the three things in those three buckets that I would say are really important to us.
Yeah, it's funny, is a couple of weeks ago, Stu and I had this conversation, you know, about that term, right? And about bust. And What I think is super interesting is Hunter Johnson was a five-star, right? And he went to Clemson, big expectations, was in kind of a log jam with some other really talented quarterbacks, super talented quarterbacks. He transferred to Stu's alma mater. I think there was huge expectations because he was a five-star going to Northwestern. To me, the biggest upshot is Hunter Johnson is walking away. He's still in college, but will walk away with a bunch of really big degrees. You know, that's really, you know, impressive how, you know, I think people may lose sight of that. When I worked on the QB book, that was the year you mentioned Cornwell was in that group, you know, but what I remembered was the two quarterbacks who seemed to struggle the most. And I think there was 18 quarterbacks that year were Kaiser, who went to Notre Dame, who had a ton of talent and was a really good kid. And I actually ran into him when he was in the NFL somewhere in an airport. But also, remember Stephen Collier? And he went to Ohio State. And Stephen Collier, I remember he threw a pick six in one of the games in the opening. You could see him kind of crushed. And obviously he didn't have a huge career at Ohio State on the field, but I either is in law school or medical school or something. Like Stephen Collier seems like, you know, he is, I hate to, you know, this is going to, people are going to make it hokey. Like it's a Butch Jones kind of term, but he's like the five-star human being, you know, what it sounds like. And so I just think that, you know, it's important not just for, you know, it's important for us in the media, honestly, to keep perspective on some of this. And I think it's going to be a little harder with NIL because there's always that rule about, oh, you know, they're not pros, so don't criticize them like pros. And yet a lot of times, you know, certainly fans are going to do what fans do. But I think, again, you know, I look back in this and I've known, you know, it's a lot of stuff comes to mind when I'm, you know, kind of going through this. And I've known John David Booty's family for years, back to when John David was probably a junior high, you know, and Josh was the man. And it was cool to hear John David talk about mental health, you know, because he comes from the most football family of any, you know, they're every bit the Mannings, you know, they're just a different side of the coin. But that, I mean, Johnny, the dad, was a big time quarterback. Josh was, you know, huge. And I just thought, to see and read and have them talk about very human issues was kind of a fascinating snapshot of that. You know, as you're looking through this book had so much more than I was kind of expecting. What surprised you the most when you kind of started going through it and kind of reteeing and getting reconnecting with some of these kids, some of these people, not kids anymore?
Well, I think the first thing was how much they enjoyed going through the process, even if it hurt, right? Like I've had 30, 40 minute phone calls with so many of these guys after they submitted their answers. I think the second thing though, and I could hear Ryan Perilou's voice right now with a Southern accent, and I never met Ryan. Like some of these guys, you know, I didn't start the Elite 11 until 2009. So I missed a group of these guys. We had 134 quarterbacks that at one point in life were named a five-star quarterback. It could have been for a week, like Cam Rising, it could have been their entire football lives, like Max Brown. So I was just trying to get a hold of Ryan Perilou because I always knew the name because he came out the same year as Mark Sanchez, who I worked with at SC. And I finally got a hold of him and he said, Yogi, and I believe this was a direct quote, I was sitting on my farm in Louisiana and somebody came up to me and said, you're the best quarterback in the world. And I said, wow. And my life changed forever. And I think there's a moment like that for all these guys when it just changes. And what they don't have, and I tested this theory out this summer at Elite 11, talking to guys now that NIL is a part of recruiting, said, how many of you have tools to deal with the attention, the expectations that others put on you? And what I learned is that most quarterbacks' tools are turning their phone off. Right. They don't have like Dr. Michael Gervais, who's in this book, a high performance psychologist, to give them tools. They don't have the Holinsky family coming in and talking to them, giving them tools. They don't have Brenda Tracy coming in and talking to them about, hey, what you can do for women in college campuses. You can set the expectation. They don't have you and Ted Robinson giving them media advice. Like they don't have that. And that's why all of those individuals were in this book. And that hit me hard. Like even talking to Will Greer about what he went through at Florida and then transferring, it's like, man, I never really even processed a lot of that until I did this book. And I think all of us and anybody listening, like if you've ever met with a therapist, or even just free written in a journal, you recognize like there is a freeing element to that. And I think a lot of these young men were like, damn, I didn't realize like I had something to say. And that's the older guys. Like, I think when you read Bo Nix and Caleb Williams and some of the younger guys, like their answers differ than what Garrett Gilbert says. You know, even Josh Rosen, I thought Josh Rosen, and you go to the chapter in the section on mid-year enrollees, it's fascinating because every other answer is the different answer. Some guys say it's the greatest thing ever. Some guys say I should never have done it. And Josh talked about when he got there to UCLA as the biggest recruit in the country, all he wanted to do was make friends. But it was hard when his locker room was full of 21, 22-year-old men. So he joined a fraternity to make friends. Well, what did the media do? Josh Rosen's in a fraternity, kid from Manhattan Beach, rich kid gets a fraternity house. Like, of course. And all of a sudden this narrative's written. Or Jimmy Clausen talked about the day that he made his commitment to Notre Dame. He got destroyed for it because of like the grandiose nature. But he's like, the staff at Notre Dame wanted me to do it because they knew it would attract a bunch of other recruits. Like, there's just so much to their stories. And that's why I love what you do, because you never jump to a conclusion. And I think now in the world of the internet, like it's, whoom, this guy sucks. He's terrible. Let's make it's a definitive hard, yeah. statement.
It's hard not to, Yogi, because I mean, there's stuff, we talked about this on our last podcast, so I don't necessarily want to steer it again to this, but like the Manti Te'o documentary blew my mind. And one of the things that I am guilty of is, I felt like I jumped to the conclusion, like everybody else did, or almost everybody else did. And it's kind of it leaves a bad taste in your mouth. You're kind of embarrassed for, there is no excuses sometimes for human nature driving you to, maybe think something that not giving people the benefit of the doubt and assuming the worst in people. That I think that can kind of happen. I do think what happens a lot, and your colleague George Whitfield, who has worked with a ton of young quarterbacks and has spent a lot of time, around Elite 11 guys, I think he's very artful and sometimes in his analogies. I remember we were talking about one particular Elite 11 quarterback recently, and he said between the QB1 documentaries, or QB1, I don't even know if they're documentaries, but the QB1 shows, and also though, kind of what kids get out of social media, there are a bunch of kids who end up thinking this is how the QB1 should act. And it's like they're acting out in real life, like they're in a TV show about, or in a movie about what the star quarterback is supposed to be like in high school, and they get caught up in it. And I think that is a harder thing for them to get untangled in. And you can have all these people, because like we all have our experiences of like what we remember hearing maybe at high school football or something, and where it can you're different than the other students. Or whatever, you're the guy, you're the ones that the other kids are going to look up to. And, it's like, you're telling that to a 15-year-old male, who, and I know you kind of counseled me on this, where people don't know who they are at that point. Their brains aren't even ready to handle it. Right. So there's a lot of stuff to sort out. And I think this book would be a great book for kids to read. I think it's a even better book really for parents to read of the players. Because there's a lot of stuff that is, I just don't know if people are ready to handle it. And I think because so much is projecting about how you think you're supposed to act and how your coach is supposed to act, maybe. And it's not, some of this feels like you may be showing weakness or what they think is weakness. And that doesn't always mesh with what we think of as football.
Yeah. I mean, it's a reason we started doing like hardcore media and storytelling training at Elite 11 now. And I lead that, and guys come in the room and I listen to them be politicians per se when they give answers. They're canned answers just like every other quarterback that they watch. And they're just modeling that behavior. And I'm trying to get them to say, oh, well, who are you? Like, what's the essence of you? And utilize that to share your story. And as I've learned is that for this generation, it's really hard. And I say that because I think there's always two conflicting realities. I feel this way even covering the Pac-12. I felt it about SC for a long time. When your community is near you outside of the facility, they're gassing you up, like how good you are all the time. Then you go into the facility and the film and your team and your staff, they know the reality. And when those two clash, you can't maximize your potential. So the story from the book is Shane Morris. Shane Morris is fundamentally the first social media quarterback. If you go back, his avatar was he and Aaron Andrews. He was a Michigan commit. It was a huge deal. One of the top guys in the country and just an amazing young man. Well, he comes out to the finals and we're running a basic, you know, it's a basic concept, right? Like a basic drive concept where like you should never throw the go route. Like in a million years, never throw the go route. And he launches the go route and it's a completion. Crowd goes wild. Everybody writes about it. The bloggers are talking about how Shane Morris just lit it up. And we get into the film room and we're like, dude, like, that's like, that's not even a fifth option. That is not an option. Like, so we dinged him on the grade. And when we released the initial Elite 11 rankings that year, he wasn't on the top 11. And I remember him coming to us saying, man, I'm going to get crushed on Twitter. And he felt the boulder of that, of the Michigan fan base and letting them down. He knew he was wrong. Like, he knew he didn't play great. He knew he had places to grow, but he just wanted to make a big play. He just wanted to gain some confidence. He just wanted to show that he could do it. And I think athletes now are feeling like they have to prove it to so many people. And so every time I see it on social media, prove the doubters wrong, prove the haters wrong, I just chime in, prove yourself right. Prove yourself right. Prove yourself right. Because it becomes you against the world. And I think that works for like Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. But I think fundamentally, most athletes, when they get to a certain place of achievement, they're like, yeah, man, like that's wasted energy. That's wasted energy. But when you're a teenager and you're an elite recruit and you're in this alpha setting, and then you go into the quarterback room, even more alpha on a college campus, and you have like Gunnar Kiel talked about, Brian Kelly lighting him up and struggling his first day and first week playing, like your confidence is rocked. And then how do you cope with it? And that's the part that can get scary of how guys manage that or mismanage that. And that's why I hope this book offers some tools. Like, you're right, it's not going to be the end all be all, and players are going to make mistakes. But if they can continue to just add to that toolbox, and if this book can be one thing, then hopefully it does its job.
Yeah, and I think it'll be more than that for anybody who really just starts to read it. If you start to read it, you will find yourself picking through. And it's the kind of book where there's so much in it that you don't necessarily have to read it from page one to page 200. You can pick different spots of it and kind of let your heart go to where it needs to go. As I said, you are the voice of the Pac-12 network. Interesting time in the conference you cover most. As I said, you used to coach at USC. I know you've been to a lot of these schools. So rather than have you go down all of them, like, give me three observations from the places you've been at that will make our listeners smarter fans about the Pac-12 going into the season.
Got you. Yeah, I've gotten to 10 of the 12 when I go back to like spring ball to through training camp.
So nobody is more plugged in the Pac-12 yeah. right now than this man. Nobody in the country.
Thank you for that, sir. But that's the job, right? Like I love that responsibility. I think a couple things. I think UCLA, and you and I have been on the UCLA train probably as well as anybody in the country in terms of watching the evolution. I think that in LA and in college football, when you think of the transfer portal, you think of USC and maybe Ole Miss because Lane's funny on Twitter, you know, and what those two schools have done. But UCLA has been remarkable. You know, if you look at the people that have transferred in, they've missed on, you'd say, one guy. One guy hadn't started for them that they found in the transfer portal over the entirety of the Chip Kelly tenure right now at UCLA. And when I look at them now and what they've done defensively, excuse me, Darius Muasau, inside linebacker, he's an all-conference player at Hawaii a year ago. They bring in the Murphy twins, play the edge. After losing two guys in the portal, I think they're going to be fine there. Liatu Latu is my freaky impact player of the year in this league. 6'5", 265, off the edge. He went to UW, he's a rugby player, had to medically retire, but got cleared, and now he's back. Then on the flip side, Zach Charbonnet. I think he's a real Heisman candidate if UCLA takes a run. And Jake Bobo will be an all-conference wideout. He's going to be the Drake London for UCLA. 6'5", can make all the plays, can body up guys. They've added some more players, but I think for one of those three is like really look at UCLA. And I had to sit down with Dorian Thompson-Robinson yesterday on my podcast where he's a five-year starter. Chip's never had anybody over 3 years run his system. Like, he's just got a different maturity about him. And this is a guy who had 304 pass attempts in high school. Most quarterbacks coming out of high school have over 1,000. Like, he's just learned on a bigger stage than anybody else. So that has been an amazing story to watch develop, and especially Dorian, like his maturity from freshman, sophomore year on even his social platforms to now. And his quote is, "I just got to love the hell out of my teammates." Like, he's an impressive guy. So that'd be one. I think two, and I'd clump these teams, having seen Stanford, Oregon State, and Cal, they're not getting the play that they, to me, deserve. Cal has top three front seven in the league. And Brett Johnson, to me, is the best interior defensive lineman in the league. Stanford offensively, you guys talked about it in your podcast, finally get a full year with his offensive line in the weight room. I love the system. I love how they're going to attack this year. And their weapons, they may not have the speed, the elite speed of SC, but they are right below it in terms of productivity at wide out and tight end. And I'm excited to watch Emmett's son, EJ Smith, at tailback, and Tanner McKee. He'll have a chance to play himself into the first round. Like, he's behind CJ and Bryce, but you go to that next tier of quarterbacks, Tanner McKee's in the conversation there. And then I think the Beavs, having watched practice there a couple days ago, sat back and I was like, I don't see a weakness. I don't see a first rounder, but I don't see a weakness. And I really think college football is about eliminating unforced errors, so much so that with my partner, Ted Robinson, who's a tennis guru, getting into the Hall of Fame this weekend in that sport as a broadcaster, unforced errors is such a critical element, and they just don't make them. They're not going to drop to the wrong spot. They're not going to miss tackles. Like, this is an improved team that I'm excited to watch. So I clump those three teams in. And then I say, thirdly, like, it's the two teams that everybody's really excited about is Oregon and SC. I'm calling SC's opener with Ted on the Pac-12 networks against Rice. And I was just up spending some time with Dan Lanning and his team in Eugene a couple days ago. Man, I'm excited for these two guys because they're both younger than 40. And I think we're about to enter this new generation of young coaches that, like, really understand the communication side of whether it's social, whether it's communicating to players, whether it's recruiting. Like, it's just different when you're talking to them than if you are with coaches that have been in the game a little bit longer, a little more seasoned as head coaches. And then the talent level, you know, Noah Sewell, Oregon, they are the best defense to me. Brandon Dorlus, Noah, and I think Christian Gonzalez is the best corner on the West Coast. Clark Phillips is in conversation for sure, so don't come at me too hard, Utah fans, but this dude can just ride. His story is amazing. David Blau is his brother-in-law, so we were all captured by David watching his wife, Melissa, in the Olympics a couple years ago. There's a lot of speed in that family, and there's a lot of talent. And then for SC, they just come at you in waves, I think, offensively. It's going to be fun to watch them score and then see what the defense evolves into under Alex Grinch. Super intriguing. And I think this league is just elevated overall, Bruce. Look at the quarterback play. Whether it's Cam Ward, Jane DeLora, you can go up and down the list. The guys that have transferred in, of course, Caleb Williams, Bo Nix, a couple of them. I'm jacked, Emory Jones, to watch this position because we've been down on the West Coast the last couple years. I take our top six starters, and now Michael Penix being announced as a starter, top seven, against any other Power Five league's top seven. Maybe not the number one at CJ and Bryce, but the collective, I don't even think it's close. And no disrespect, I love those leagues, but I think if you really look at it, you say, well, okay, yeah, dude, like, you guys have all played really well. So I'm finally excited about this position, and I think it's back on the West Coast.
All right, Yogi, you got me fired up about some West Coast football again. As always, it's been great talking to you. Again, the book is The Five-Star QB. Wrote it with Joey Roberts, and it's really, just pick it up if you're a football fan, or if you're really, you know, if you have a kid who's a young athlete, definitely pick it up. I just thought it was, I hate to say it like this, but it was so much more than what I was expecting when I opened the package, just because there's a lot of stuff in there that maybe you don't think about that you should think about. So thanks for joining us today on the Audible.
Bruce, as always, a blast. The best part was talking to you. Second best part is that you were wearing a Pitt t-shirt while we're talking. So lots of love in that regard, man. Thanks again.
Okay, Stu, now we are pleased to be joined by our expert on all things Nebraska, Mitch Sherman, who is coming to us live from Dublin, where the Huskers are going to play Northwestern. Look, I got to ask the question right out of the gate, Mitch. Last year, this was actually the only game that felt like it went well for Nebraska. They blew out Northwestern, still went 3-9, as you've written a lot about. That was kind of an epically frustrating year with so many close games. They have had some staff changes, especially on the offensive side of the ball. What would you say is the biggest reason for Nebraska fans to be optimistic that Scott Frost can actually get this thing turned around?
Funny, Bruce, I'm actually writing about that topic for a story that's going to publish tomorrow, which would be Thursday as we record this. From some reporting that I did today in Dublin, today's my first day on the ground in Dublin, I would say the biggest reason for Nebraska and its 10,000 fans who are following the Huskers overseas to this game to be optimistic is all the change. And you hinted at the change, you suggested that, but 5 new assistant coaches, mainly it's the 18 transfers. That's 15 from Division I schools and 3 from junior colleges. And there could be as many of as a dozen of those transfers who are put in roles where they're asked to do important things for Nebraska, whether it's starting or being key reserves, or in the case of their punter and their kicker, transform the special teams. So this is, you know, in no way yet the on the level of what Mel Tucker did at Michigan State last year, but that's, you know, we know where the bar is, and I don't think that there's a major award winner in this group like Kenneth Walker, but there are some pretty big time talents when you look at O'Shawn Mathis, the edge rusher from TCU, when you look at Tommy Hill, the corner from Arizona State, who's going to start Saturday against Northwestern. Trey Palmer, the wide receiver from LSU, is a significant talent upgrade for Nebraska at that position. I haven't even mentioned Casey Thompson, the quarterback from Texas, who has won the starting job and is a fifth-year junior who's 23 years old and started 10 games for the Longhorns last year and is now healthy after having thumb surgery following the spring in Lincoln. So that's just the top group. There's a second tier and third tier of players and that all are going to be asked to do big things, including Brian Buscini and Timmy Bleakrode, the punter and kicker out of the FCS, who were among the best at their jobs last year. And that's something that should be able to translate to the FBS. And that's just been a disaster for Nebraska. Just improving the special teams, Bruce, is worth a couple wins.
Just to follow up on that, though, so for the people who are surprised Scott Frost still has his job, we know he brought in Mark Whipple, who did a really good job at Pitt. Have you seen much of a change, if at all, from Scott and how he's handling things? We know there's obviously staff changes. We know he has a new boss that he, you know, that's relatively new still in Trev Alberts. Is it the same Scott Frost who took over, you know, when he was riding high coming from UCF, coming back home? Or do you know, you're around him a lot. Do you feel like it's different?
Yeah, it's different. It's different. And it's been different. That was a 2018, 2019 thing for Scott Frost. I think the whole flap with the Big Ten going into the 2020 season really marked a turning point for just the way that he was viewed and kind of the way that he carried himself. He became more guarded. He was already guarded, but he became even more so. And it's been a kind of a downhill slide since then. They had the NCAA investigation, and Frost still has a 5-day suspension this season that he has to serve during the season, presumably during a bye week. But that's still not a small thing. As a result of the findings of the NCAA on that flap that Nebraska had over using an improper assistant coach, it's just been a lot of one black eye after another. The attempt to cancel the Oklahoma game a year ago during the spring. He had the mishap last week with talking about his offensive lineman vomiting in practice, and that was an exaggeration, and he walked it back a couple of days later. But these are just things that don't need to be happening for Nebraska and Scott Frost. He's in his seventh year as a head coach, and it's a little bit surprising that he continues to fall in some of these same traps. But I guess, you know, if you know him and you know who he is and his personality, I mean, he's not somebody who changes a great deal overnight. So from that standpoint, maybe it's not surprising, but yeah, there's a difference in the way that aside from all of that, there's a difference in the way that he carries himself. He is close to the best. And I think there's a difference in the way that he's coaching this team, especially this year in letting go of the offense. He's giving control to Mark Whipple. Mark Whipple's calling the plays. It's something that Scott Frost has done dating back to his days at Oregon as OC for Mark Helfrich. And this is Whipple's offense. Frost is walking around, helping with the line. He's over with the defense. He's working with the special teams in the practice time that we've had an opportunity to see this fall. And that's going to be the story, a big storyline for Nebraska this year, is that if this offense succeeds, it's Mark Whipple who is pulling the strings. So I think it's going to look different. And there's reason to believe that Frost is changing in the way that he approaches this team.
Nothing illustrates the change between the difference between Bruce and myself more than we get you on here from Ireland. And the first question he asked, you know, I want to know about the pubs. I want to know about the scene.
Yeah.
And first question, he goes straight to the football, you know, got to admire the brand. But we will get to that in a second, but just I'll close the loop here. Okay. So you did a good job articulating the reasons for people to be optimistic. I did my Big Ten predictions the other day on the site.
I saw this.
I just don't buy it. I couldn't see it.
Reasonable.
So I have them 4-8. If that happens, that will mean what happened. Like, we know what would happen to Scott Frost, but like, what would have gone wrong for that to happen?
Well, Whipple said it today here in Dublin. Let's not give away the game in the first quarter. These are the things that are going through the minds of Nebraska coaches and players. And he's kind of a breath of fresh air as a 65-year-old offensive coordinator. You know, he's not really been at the kind of a program where the spotlight is on in the way that it is at Nebraska. And I don't mean the national spotlight. I just mean the spotlight and the way that they're covered on a local basis and in the way that they're covered by us. You know, we cover Nebraska closely enough that we're going to hang on the words of what these coaches say. And Mark Whipple, you know, from the time that he said Casey Thompson was the top quarterback on the day of Nebraska's first spring practice, to some of the things that he said about the offense and the confidence of players here in fall camp, to today, 3 days before the opener, coming out and saying, we don't want to lose the game in the first quarter. He's brutally honest. And I think that's a real concern for Nebraska, that it's going to fall down some of those same holes that hurt it a year ago. I mean, in the Illinois game, you remember this, in week zero, it was just one unwatchable mistake after another, from taking a safety on a punt return to a scoop and score touchdown for the Illini on a fumble by Adrian Martinez, the quarterback who's now at Kansas State, to a 30-yard penalty by Caleb Tanner, Nebraska's defensive end, who's now a captain, by the way, and you know, to his credit, has changed a lot in his approach to the game. But there's still that danger that if the snowball starts going downhill for Nebraska, it's not going to know how to react. It's going to fold under the adversity and suffer many of the same consequences that have caused it to go 15-29 in 4 years under Scott Frost. I'm with you in that I'm not convinced that they've fixed this.
Yeah. And part of it to me was just, as I'm looking at the West, you know, even if Nebraska is better, I think Iowa is a much better team and a much better program right now. I actually think Minnesota.
Better program.
Yeah, Minnesota is going to have a better team this year. Purdue rises up last year and shows signs of life. And obviously Wisconsin's always there. So, you know, they're playing catch up. And they might be running out of time. Real quick for the 5 Northwestern fans who might be listening right now. I mean, even though I have Nebraska winning 2 Big Ten games, I do have them winning this one, just mostly because I don't think Northwestern has a quarterback still. Northwestern does win this. Like, if there is a chance for them, you know, I do think they have 2 really good running backs, Cam Porter and Evan Hull. Cam Porter was injured last year, but he came on as a freshman. So I think that'll be an interesting, you're going to find out pretty quickly, I think, if Nebraska has a rush defense, because if they don't, you know, those guys could run for quite a few yards. All right. Now what I really want to know about: a college football game in Ireland. I know it's been done before, but obviously this is your first time. Does it feel like a bowl game? Does it feel like a preseason game? Like, well, what's the vibe there?
Neither of those, really, because there's such a serious feel around it from the Nebraska perspective that I've covered. I mean, they understand the importance of this. And so a preseason game would really be a misnomer for the, I mean, for more the way that the vibe is. Yeah.
Vibe around town. You have,
I got you.
Assume both teams fans, although I'm sure Nebraska will have way more.
Yeah. The planes coming over here and all the reports that I've seen, they've been full, and mine was this way, just completely full of Nebraska fans and their red. And thankfully they were quiet on the 7-hour flight from Atlanta that left at 10 PM yesterday. It didn't help me sleep, but at least I was able to relax. There's a lot of Nebraska fans here. So in that sense, it does feel a little bit like a bowl game where Nebraska fans travel en masse, whether it's, you know, San Diego or Miami or Phoenix or whatever it was in the days when Nebraska played in bowl games. But it feels like nothing that I've ever been around when it comes to college football. Let me put it that way. I'm having a hard time describing it because I don't know that I've seen anything like this. First of all, the stadium is this like weird spaceship kind of looking thing. It has this metal like crown over the backwards half crown over the top of it that keeps like some of the fans dry if it rains, but the whole field is open. There is not a press box. So
Stu, I will be outside.
So I will be outside. They have some nice tables set up in the third deck, in the upper deck. I think we would get wet if it rains. So the coaches who are in the booth are in a suite down on the end zone side of the lengthwise direction of the field. So they're going to have a weird view in the way that they see things. Everything's weird about it. So, you know how these NFL stadiums and the big college stadiums have Memorial Stadium at Nebraska, the electronic ribbon boards that display messages, whether they're scores or school logos, whatever it might be. They're just a new scoreboard, a new technology in scoreboards. They don't have that here. So they have like these posterized ribbon boards that have Northwestern, Chicago's Big Ten team. Because what resonates more in Dublin, Stu, than the phrase Chicago's Big Ten team? This is a Northwestern home game. That's still a reason they're playing this.
Oh, I was like, why would they bring that to? Okay, they're trying to bring their signage from Ryan Field over to Ireland. I got it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is Northwestern gave up the home game. I mean, some history, some background on this. Nebraska was supposed to play Illinois in this game, the Aer Lingus Classic, a year ago, and that got canceled because of difficulties in being able to plan it around the pandemic, and we didn't know what restrictions were going to exist in August of 2021 early enough to get this thing going. So here we are in 2022, and we're finally playing this game, and it's, you know, Northwestern was willing to step in and give up a home game, make some money, presumably, but there's only going to be about 35,000 people there.
Let me tell you something. That's more than would have been there at Ryan Field for a September 3rd game against Rice. I'll tell you that right now.
Against a September 3rd game against Rice, but a October game against Nebraska, you might have had 20,000 Nebraska fans there. Here it's going to be half that number of Nebraska fans. And maybe 1,000 or 2,000 Northwestern fans. My cab driver today, leaving the airport, was explaining to me that the British American football fans. So they've been exposed to the game from the NFL games in London. That they will come across the Irish Sea.
Interesting.
Yeah, I wonder, will they? You know, maybe he's remembering the Notre Dame Navy appearance at the Aer Lingus Classic from a few years ago. Because I understand the appeal of Notre Dame playing in Ireland, and I could see that drawing people from the UK side, the England side, UK, Northern Ireland is part of the UK, so I'm not talking about that. But from London and cities across the Irish Sea. We'll see. I'm interested in what the crowd looks like because that's going to help dictate the atmosphere in this thing. I'm sure the Nebraska fans will make some noise, but if it's half empty, that's going to be, it's going to, then it will feel like a bowl game. How about that?
It's too bad. I mean, it is a really cool thing they're doing. It's too bad that, you know, you can't control this, but that the teams are coming off 3-9 seasons, right? Northwestern fans actually travel very well to bowl games. I think they would be excited to go to Dublin if they were coming off the season before, right? Where they finished, I think, 10th in the country, not 3-9. And then Nebraska, you know, I think those fans follow them through thick and thin. But in terms of local interest there, you know, if they were coming to see the mighty powerhouse Nebraska, that might be a different sell for in Dublin than, because I'm just surprised at the idea that, like, the NFL is a worldwide sport. People watch it everywhere. You know, even my friends who are college football fans from America who live in Europe say it's very hard to find the games on Saturdays, that they have very limited, you know, so I just can't imagine a lot of the locals have even watched college football, much less these two teams.
I think the hope of the game organizers is that just the draw of American football and something that resembles the NFL, like if you just turn it on, it might take you a play or two to recognize that this is not the New York Giants out there. So they do a good job of embracing. I can tell you from my few hours here in Dublin, and I walked around today before I went to the media availability at the stadium, they do a good job of embracing this game. And the people who put this on have put signage all over town. There were purple and red balloons at the airport to welcome the teams that were still there. Northwestern just got in a couple hours before me this morning. They came a day after Nebraska, which is interesting because there is some acclimation that's required when you lose 6 hours. So we'll see if that shows up on Saturday. Probably not. They don't mail it in Dublin. Let's say that they are putting on enough of a show to make it look like they care about this game. And we'll see if enough people come out and buy tickets. You can't buy tickets at the stadium on the day of the game. That's another difference. They all have to be purchased ahead of time. There will be no box office. There are no credentials, Stu, for this game that have been made. I don't know that I will. I've requested one, and I'm confident that I'll be in the stadium in a working area. But I do not have a credential that's been issued to me.
So theoretically, anybody in the stadium could try to do the post game interviews
at the stadium on Saturday afternoon. So it's a unique deal, and I think Pat Fitzgerald and Scott Frost, either one of them, I know that both of them would prefer not to be playing this game here, but here we are. And Nebraska will turn around and fly home immediately after the game. At least Northwestern has next week off, but right. Nebraska will turn around and fly home right after this game, get back at 3-4 in the morning, which is going to be like 6 hours ahead on their adjusted clocks, and start getting ready for North Dakota. At least it's not North Dakota State.
That's what I was just going to say. I think if they were playing North Dakota State after all that jet lag, and that would be real problematic. North Dakota, although North Dakota was in the playoffs 2 years ago, so they're not like a complete slouch, but that's a break there. Well, Mitch, I know you well, and I know you well enough to know that you were very kind to do this, but I can tell you are extremely jet lagged and need to get some sleep. So we appreciate you staying up to come on the Audible. Have fun Saturday. Obviously, all those of us back here are just excited to have a college football game to watch.
I'm excited too. Looking forward to seeing football again. So thanks for having me on.
All right. Time for the mailbag, Stu. As always, send your questions to the audiblepod@gmail.com. Our first question, and it's a good one, from Saad Raza. Hey, Stu and Bruce, can you clarify something for me, please? Exactly how much money will the SEC be making per year with its ESPN media deal? The reports I'm seeing about the Big Ten are for around $8 billion in total, but all I can find about the SEC is a $300 million game of the week deal. The Big Ten is expected to distribute $80 to $100 million per year to each member institution. How much will the SEC be distributing to each member institution a year?
Great question, and is a mystery that I myself have been trying to track down. Every other Power 5 conference, when they announce a TV deal, the number immediately gets out. For whatever reason, so the SEC already has a deal with ESPN. This game of the week one is adding to that, right? And part of the deal with ESPN is the SEC network. Search far and wide. There has never been an exact number reported for how much ESPN is paying them for that. So here's the best I can give you. If you, the one time we can kind of peel back the curtain a little bit is on their tax returns. On the SEC's tax return last year, under TV and radio rights fees, they list $588 million. Now, it's a little tricky because when you see that figure, for instance, that the Big Ten, you know, the 1.1 whatever per year, that's an average. $300 million per year for the SEC Game of the Week, that's an average. It starts out lower than that, and by the end, it's higher than that. But let's just use that 300 figure. So if they're making 588 now, and that goes up a little bit every year, and they're going to add 300, well, actually, minus the SEC 55. So we're going to add 245. So where are we at now? 780, about 830, 830. They're also adding two more schools. And from what we understand, they get a pro rata increase. So it keeps it the same per school as it is now. So add another, we'll say 80. And you're up to around 900 million. And it's probably a little more than that, but I'm just being conservative. So that's not what the Big Ten's making, but it's not like drastically behind what the Big Ten's making. My best guess would be if in a few years the Big Ten schools are making $80 million per year, the SEC schools are making like $72 million per year. The Big Ten will be ahead, but it won't be some massive discrepancy. Guess what? Longtime friend of the podcast, we haven't heard from in a while, Jason Gorlewski, Columbia, South Carolina, Bruce and Stewart. I lived in Atlanta for 10 years and Georgia Tech was always respectable and occasionally good, great. By the way, I lived in Atlanta for 5 years and they were actually the better program than Georgia for the first couple of those years with Joe Hamilton. I've never seen them bottom out the way they have recently. Why is Georgia Tech so bad right now? I believe Bruce mentioned that the school is a potential sleeping giant years ago. They're in a huge football state and a huge football city. They're in a conference with one playoff threat and everyone else stuck in neutral. It seems like they could quickly become relevant. Is it just a bad coaching hire? Is it a transition from option football to normal football? Being in the same state as UGA, Bruce, what do you think?
I think it's a lot of those things Jason mentioned. The reason why I've a lot of coaches I know recruit Atlanta, and they really have thought Georgia Tech for a lot of reasons, including it's a great academic institution. There was just a lot, you know, look, Bobby Ross won a national title there. Not once upon a time. It wasn't like 80 years ago. It was like 30 years ago. But the challenges you have are the things that Jason touched on, which is you have Kirby Smart in the way they're recruiting. Everybody recruits in that part of the state. You even have certainly, you know, even like Kentucky's going in there getting 4-star linebackers out of that area. And so it's just, it's a challenge to battle out. And then what I think is an interesting point that somebody in the ACC made to me is here's Jeff Collins, who by all accounts is a really good recruiter and, you know, brings a lot of energy and has been around big time programs, but the best player he had in the program and is definitely a franchise kind of guy. Well, the way the portal is, he loses Jamar Gibbs to Alabama. You know, it's like now it doesn't take much for a player to bail. And all of a sudden that can set you back. So I also think it's not a insignificant point to be the coach who has to follow Paul Johnson and the system that he was recruiting to. And so there was definitely going to be a lot of growing pains. And I think that has happened. And I don't think they're going to be irrelevant, but I definitely think you have a first-time head coach who struggled to get much traction there. I'm interested to see if they can take the leap to at least be a 5 or 6 win team this year to give people enough confidence to go, yeah, he deserves more time to keep recruiting there. I mean, if I ask you, Stu, just on your surface, do you think Jeff Collins will be the head coach at Georgia Tech a year from now?
I do not. I think that, you know, you've talked about Big 12. I did my ACC predictions on Monday, and I got to tell you, it's going to be a dogfight between Georgia Tech and Duke for not only which one will be the worst Power 5 team in the ACC, but possibly the worst of any Power 5 team. Georgia Tech has got almost nothing coming back. Like you said, some of their best players transferred. They were already losing a lot of starters from a team that wasn't very good to begin with. Jeff Sims has been up and down as a quarterback. Just doesn't seem like he seems like his ceiling is not what you would hope it would be. So I think, you know, he's been 3-9, 3-7, 3-9. I think it's probably going to be another season like that and possibly worse. So what do you think?
I think I should disclose to our listener that you went to the dentist this morning because you are really pissy right now, it seems like. And so it's like, it's the episode of Mick McCall for you. It's like you just buried Texas. Now you're burying Georgia Tech.
But I gave Kansas State fans hope of the best season in a long, long time. The funny thing about predictions is they're very easy for other people to look at and say, gosh, you're way too down this team. You're way too down. Well, then tell me who you think will be better instead. So if you think, are you suggesting Georgia Tech's going to rise up and save Jeff Collins?
I think if they can get to 5 wins, they could get Jeff Collins another year.
Okay. So if they're going to get to 5 wins, we're going to play your favorite game.
Okay. I know what you're going to do.
All right. I'm going to read you the schedule. We're going to do this. Usually you're the one asking me to do this. All right. Yeah. Here we go. Opening weekend, Monday night, Clemson.
Loss.
Western Carolina.
Win.
Ole Miss.
Loss.
At UCF.
Loss.
At Pitt.
Loss.
Duke.
Win.
There's two. Virginia at home.
Unless Brendan Armstrong hurt, I think that's probably a loss.
At Florida State.
Loss.
At Virginia Tech.
All right, Stu, this isn't going so good.
And now you see where we land at 3-9.
No.
Because haven't even gotten to Miami and Georgia.
I know, and Georgia's on the road. North Carolina's technically gone. I mean, the last 4-5 games, it's 4 road games. One of them is Georgia, and then the only one that's not a road game is Miami. You know, like if you run the risk of, you know, they could be dead man walking if they cannot knock off UCF on the road, Pitt on the road. Like they need one of those two games to get to, like, let's say they're 2-3 hosting Duke. If they can get to 2-3 hosting Duke and then they beat Duke, 3 wins, I think then they have a chance to at least have a little bit of momentum and, you know, maybe knock somebody else off.
Right.
But yeah, I see.
Well, regardless of how Georgia Tech does in 2022, Georgia Tech, to me, you can win at Georgia Tech. Maybe Jeff Collins couldn't get it done. I do think the transition from a triple option program for a decade, or, you know, actually 12 or 13 years to modernized offense was always going to be a challenge. Like you said, recruiting, I think, has gotten harder because the SEC is just so omnipresent. But Paul Johnson was not exactly working with, you know, a bunch of 4 and 5 stars. And he went 9-4, 11-3, 8-5, 7-6, 11-3, 9-4, you know, he won. And there's no reason why another coach, you don't have to run the triple option to win at Georgia Tech. There's enough players in that area. And also, you know, what says that Virginia Tech can win, but Georgia Tech can't? I mean, and there's so many other programs like that in the ACC that have no.
Wake is winning.
Wake is winning.
The smallest school. And so, yeah, why not? If you have the right coach.
Yeah. There's nothing with the right coach. There's nothing stopping them from being a regular 8-9 win kind of team. All right, Bruce, this one's for you because I don't want to answer. No, I'll help you. John in Cincinnati, who do you think will have a better first season as DC at their respective schools? Jim Knowles at the Ohio State University or Jesse Minter at U of M? Knowles, recent success, has a ton of talent, but how long will it take to implement a new system? Minter, his most recent DC experience was a tough season at Vandy, but he's bringing the same system they ran last year, so the transition could be smoother. Losing 3 first-round level talents will hurt the D, but is still littered with 4 of your, Bruce, top 50 freaks. So who you got? Who's going to have the better first season?
I think Jim Knowles will have the better first season, in part because it's a perception thing. Ohio State was there's not much room to be better than what Michigan was last year. They were a top 15 defense under Mike McDonald. And, you know, as John said, I mean, there's continuity because of where Jesse Minter came from and those guys were close. They've worked together. I think they're still really good players, but whereas Ohio State, it feels a little like, you know, I thought Jeff Hafley was one of the best hires Ryan Day made a few years back. He came in and had a huge impact on them, not just scheme wise, but technique wise and the things he emphasized. I think Jim Knowles, I don't know if they can make as big a jump, but I think they can be really good. And the other thing is, this is my preseason national title team. So,
oh, you heard it here first.
Yeah. So, and this is not a knock on Jesse Minner. I think they can be close to as good as they were last year. I think they have, I think they're probably going to be better at the corner than they were when Mike took over, just because they really, I think they missed on a lot of recruits at the time. They have as somebody, a single dominant guy like Aiden Hutchinson, but Mozzie Smith's going to be a problem inside. They have a bunch of edge guys. Junior Colson can really run at linebacker. I think they'll be good. I just think when you look at Ohio State, Jim Knowles is going to inherit the D-line room. I think has been restocked. It was a little bit of a hiccup for a little while where you had some young guys and some good players, but maybe not any great players. I think they're getting back to that. I still don't think they're you know, terrific at linebacker. I mean, Jim Knowles probably had a better playmaker in the middle of his defense last year in Stillwater and Malcolm Rodriguez than what he's going to have here. They have some pieces in the secondary. I will go with Jim Knowles there just because I think they're a national title team.
That was a sufficient answer on defense. I just have a quick question for you. So I think, you know, you're not going to see many people pick a team other than Alabama or Ohio State. So it's not like you were making some radical pick there. I'm going with Alabama for the national championship. Are you at all concerned? Like, they have CJ Stroud, they have Jackson Smith and Jigba, Travion Henderson. We think they're going to score like 1,000 points a game. Are you at all concerned about Ohio State's offensive line?
Not really. I think as good as Knowles is, I think Justin Fry, the O-line coach, who's been with Ryan Day before, is a really under the radar addition. I think he's going to be a great fit there. So I'm not that worried about the O-line at all. So I'm not.
Well, then in that case, you might be right about them winning the national championship. I think their defense is not going to be back to like Chase Young era level, but it should be a lot better. There's still plenty of talent there. Whatever that, you know, you remember last year, it just wasn't working from that Oregon game on. They got a little bit better, but that scheme was just not working. So what Jim Knowles did at Oklahoma State was phenomenal, and he didn't have nearly the, you know, number of five-star recruits or future NFL players that he will have in Columbus. All right, as always, you can send your emails to the audiblepod@gmail.com. Bruce, have a happy Saturday watching college football this weekend.
Can't wait.
See you guys next time.